As I hammered in the last bolt and staggered over the rim, it was not at all clear to me who was the conqueror and who was the conquered. Warren Harding.
You know, we like put in a lot of effort to make sure that we could climb this very intense peak safely, and we were able to execute on that. So that was like, you know, that feels really good. Like there was one kind of incident near the top where I was hit by an avalanche and took fall, but even like, you know, I walked away from that, which was awesome. But even if I had, you know, hurt myself, we had like so much experience on the team in terms of rescues and for, you know, first aid, medical stuff, that it's like, it would have been fine. So it would have been a different story, of course. But yeah, it was like, we really put in a lot of effort to like keep it reeled in so that we could feel good about what we were doing versus, you know, climbing. It can be kind of tempting to like push over the edge and like do things that are kind of out there. But it's like, you know, that's not how you become an old climber.
I'm Doc. And this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the trail, Dirt Bags and Hiker Trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. This week, we are talking to alpinist, storyteller, climate advocate, and the newly anointed board president of the American Alpine Club, Graham Zimmerman. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Graham. How's it going?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm really happy to be here. And I'm good. I'm in Central Oregon right now, and it's kind of the perfect time of year to be here. We've got, you know, snow in the mountains, and the rock climbing's great. Life is good.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now there is a peculiar American thru hiking tradition of handing out trail names. Doesn't really happen in Europe. Doesn't really happen in other disciplines. I know that you are an alpinist, not necessarily a thru hiker. Have you picked up a nickname or a trail name out there?
It's a good question. I go by GZ a lot, which isn't like quite as creative or cool as the through hiking name, nickname tradition, but that's about as close as I've got.
All right. GZ works. If you don't mind, I'll refer to you as GZ.
Have at it.
It has a flair to it. I like it. Obviously GZ being your initials. For any of our listeners who may have missed your name at the beginning.
Yes.
Okay.
not particularly creative, but
but it works. It works. because if you're out there climbing and there's like some kind of emergency, there's a, you know, a rock falling, or you need to belay, you're belaying somebody and there's an emergency. Graham Zimmerman, that is a lot of syllables to get out, right? GZ is like immediate. I mean, you can get your attention right away.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Hey, GZ, have you ever listened to the podcast?
I unfortunately have not. I tend to listen to political science podcasts, which is, you know, not something we need to get into. But I have not listened to this podcast, although I do have a lot of friends who are into thru hiking, which I really like. It is a culture that I really appreciate. So it's really nice. Cool to be.
So after you have a fantastic experience tonight on the podcast, you can share this with all your friends and let them know, hey, this is a something you should listen to.
Hell yeah.
Okay. The only reason I ask, I want to make sure that you're aware of a segment towards the end of the episode called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week. And that's where I will turn to you and ask you for some outdoor adventure wisdom to share with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So don't be surprised when we get there.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Give some picks.
The must bring gear review.
Oh, that's nice. That's my youngest daughter, Half Calf, there introducing the next segment. This is the must bring gear review, sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company Six Moon Designs. And here's how it works, GZ. If you were to let your stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day excursion, I'm not going to say hike, it could be, you know, a climb. What is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So, GZ, what is your must bring piece of gear?
Well, you know, in climbing, you're touching the mountain with your hands and your feet. So that tends to mean that your boots and your gloves are the most important pieces of kit. I mean, there's a lot of important kit, like in all of these practices, but those are the two things that you need to fit really well. You can, if you're ice climbing, you can add crampons to that. If you're rock climbing, it could be rock shoes, but let's see, for years I've been using, boots and rock shoes from a brand called Scarpa, which is based in Italy. I think they're some of the best on the market. They certainly are for me. And I will say though, the most important thing is they fit your feet right. So that's always like, you know, Scarpa is the best for me. They're fantastic, fantastic kicks. But whenever you're looking for shoes, always make sure and go try a bunch on to make sure they fit correctly. And then with gloves, I've been wearing outdoor research gloves forever, and they are. I really do think they are the best in the industry. So those are kind of the two most important things. Or would you touch the mountain with?
Solid reasoning there. That if where you're touching the mountain, that's very important because you want to stay on the mountain.
Yeah, you want to stick to that thing.
That's right. And you know what? I can't wait to get into climbing talk with you because I have a lot of questions. There are, you know, so we talk a lot about hiking, through hiking, those types of adventures on this podcast, but we are not limited to those topics. So this is an adventure, outdoor adventure, podcast. We've taken many side trips, along outdoor adventure, including, big wall climbing and alpinism. So I can't wait to hear some more from you on this. So
very nice.
Okay.
It's the hiking pole.
Okay. So this is now, the hiking pole segment, and this will help us continue our talk possibly about gear and other philosophies. And really this poll is designed to help me give you a rating, a score from 1 to 100 on the sanity scale, with 100 being completely sane and 1 being absolutely bonkers. So
okay.
Got some tricky questions here. Let's see if you can navigate them. Right now they are through hiking related or hiking related. If you know, I asked you a question and you have a similar maybe analogy to climbing, maybe we could change that question. But let's get your initial impressions here.
Great.
Okay. So on a hike, trekking poles or no trekking poles?
Wait, you got to remind me of the scale. What's the scale again?
Oh no, you're just answering the question in terms of okay. Absolutely, I would use that, or no, I would. No, there's no way in heck I would do that, or you know, whatever the choice might be.
Perfect. I definitely use trekking poles. I've spent the last 15 years in the mountains, and trekking poles help with your knees. So that's like, I'm pretty in on trekking poles.
Absolutely. Now,
just one.
I've run into a number of climbers out in the backcountry, and they are carrying a ton of gear. So they're doing hiking. They're hiking out there to get to where they're going to do the climb, right? And there is a hiking component to this.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, like in the Karakoram, lots of times, you know, it's can be a week long walk to base camp. So like, there's definitely a hiking component to this.
Right.
And my investment in alpine climbing tends to be things that are unclimbed, and those are oftentimes far away or hard to get to. So there is definitely a lot of walking to get there.
Right. Now, maybe I didn't mention that there are seven questions. So that was the first one, one down. Good answer so far. No point deductions at this point. So,
okay, good. I'm winning.
Okay. Winning. That's right. All right. Hey, on the hike to where you're going to climb, boots or trail runners?
Ooh,
you don't wear your climbing. You're not going to hike in your climbing shoes. Those are not hiking. That's not hiking.
I'm kind of like if I don't have a big pack on, it's more of a trail runner thing. Now, if you're up in the mountains and you're like walking across glaciers and things like that, then you for sure have boots on. But if it is conceivable for me to have trail runners on, that's what I'll be wearing.
Okay. All right. Now, if you have to do an overnight experience out there before you get to the climb, you're in terms of your shelter, do you prefer a tent, tarp, hammock, bivy, or cowboy camping?
I bring a tent, you know, in the mountains. Like for me, you know, there are some things you can do to kind of make sure that you can keep your ducks in a row. In the mountains, the weather can get pretty bad up there. So having a tent that you can hunker down in can really save your bacon sometimes. So I tend to always bring a tent with me.
Okay. Makes sense. And I think I know how this next question is going to go based on your previous answers. You prefer, in terms of your sleeping system, a sleeping bag or a quilt?
Oh, sleeping bag for sure. I think the quilt thing's cool, but I like to be all wrapped up.
Do you kind of run warm or run cold?
It's a good question. I think I kind of sleep pretty well in the medium, but you know, if we're up en route, I'll bring a really, really light bag. Oftentimes one without a zipper. It's like one of the kind of ultralight things. And I will wear, oftentimes have down socks, down pants, and a down jacket with me. And so I'll wear those inside of the sleeping bag. And what that allows me to do is then if I'm like all like rappelling a route in the middle of the night or something like that, and it's real cold, then I can actually wear all that clothing when we're out in the elements, or if it's stormy, or if it's just wicked cold. And so it kind of makes it so that a bunch of my sleeping kit is actually like more useful. It doesn't only come out when I'm sleeping. It's like it gets used quite a bit. And then you kind of have this like, you know, ultralight sleeping bag that kind of brings everything together and gives you a little more insulation while you're sleeping.
Yeah. When you're up in the mountains, it's good to have layers.
Yes.
And you mentioned ultralight. When you're doing a big climb, how much are you carrying out there? What is the weight of your kit?
When we're en route, I haven't been as much of a weight nerd for a number of years, but like in the realm of like 20 to 25 pounds.
That sounds very reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, man, if you're going to be like climbing hard pitches, you can't have too much on your back.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. In terms of food out there, this is a very important question. Huge point deduction if you answer the wrong way. So be very careful here.
Right.
I'm not encouraging you to pick what you think is a safe option. I want to hear the truth, but I'm just giving you a heads up here. All right. So when it comes to food, are you a stove guy, cold soak, or stoveless?
Oh, I'm a stove guy. You know, all the science says that having a warm drink will increase your mental state and make you feel better. So, and then when it's real cold, it's important. And then the other thing is like most of the places where I'm spending a lot of time, there's not actually any liquid water. So, so that's how you get water from, by melting snow and ice.
Yeah. GZ, did you just quote science on this answer? Or have there been studies done that you're referring to here?
Oh yeah. Yeah, man. That was like one of the original, what was that podcast? I don't know, the NPR science podcast. Oh no, now I'm losing my memory. Yeah. But there have been studies done on like, even if it's a hot day, having a hot drink will still increase your mood.
Okay. There you go. Science. The man is bringing science into the hiking pool. Fantastic. All right. Is life better above or below the tree line?
Above. Oh yeah. Easy.
Why above?
Oh, because that's where the best climbing is.
For the mountains. All right, last question in the hiking poll here. What's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
Ooh, man, that's a hard question, because you know there's an old saying in climbing that you can't put a price on morale. So like oftentimes I will, if we are en route, I trim it way down. I trim down wherever possible. But then again, like man, when I'm at base camp, I will bring a big sleeping pad. I will bring, you know, like I'll bring some creature comforts, because you know, it's like, it tends to be in climbing that you get to base camp and then you're up en route and you don't have enough food. You're not bringing very much kit. You're like, you know, you're up there just kind of hauling ass. And then when you get down, you need to recover, particularly if you're going to be like looking at multiple climbs. So it's kind of like, you got to be able to oscillate between ultralight and going super hard and then being able to recover effectively. And so to recover effectively, like having a sleeping pad that's a little bigger, having a couple pairs of fresh socks, you know, that kind of stuff can like really, really make your day a lot better. So I'd say like somewhere in between.
Okay. Now, follow-up question to that. You mentioned ultralight and weight and being able to haul ass. Are you the kind of guy that drills holes in your toothbrush to allow, so you can save those grams to bring grams of luxury items?
Yeah. Sometimes like on route for sure. Like cutting holes and like cutting off bits of your toothbrush, or maybe just not bringing a toothbrush.
Not bringing a toothbrush. Awesome.
It's like 2 days, right? It's like not always that long. So I like once again, kind of on route, like, you know, you're trimming it down as much as possible. There's a lot of stuff you have to bring. There's a lot of ropes and gear and, you know, safety equipment, and then if you're gonna sleep en route, you need a full sleeping system and a stove and all that kind of thing. So And so it's like, you know, like you got to really trim down where you can.
Okay. Hey, let me do some quick math here to tally up your score. I'm going to carry the 3. I'm going to divide by, the root of 2, multiply by pi, and we're going to adjust for the atmospheric pressure at the top of Whitney. And I come up with a very sane score of 95. That may be the highest score we've ever had on the podcast here.
Golly gee, look at that.
Yeah, impressive. You're a new record holder. It's not exactly a golden axe, but you know, it's up there.
Hey, I'll take it.
Okay. Very good. Hey, before we get too far down the trail, or maybe it should be, you know, too far up the mountain in this case, let's stop. Let's back up a little bit. And I'd love to hear your background, kind of where you grew up, if you were involved in it, what kind of sports and hobbies you were involved in growing up, and was outdoor adventure, was that part of your family life? Did your family take you out and do those kinds of activities when you were growing up? So let's hear your origin story.
Yeah, let's see. So I was actually born overseas. So I was born down in New Zealand. My folks were expats down there at the time.
Do you have dual citizenship?
I do, yeah.
So you're a Kiwi as well? Kiwi and a Yank?
I'm a Kiwi and a Yank, indeed.
All right.
Totally. Let's see. So born down there, then moved up to the States, to the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area when I was, I don't know, like 4. My folks are not, my folks are like adventurous people, but they're actually from the Midwest. So they didn't like mountains and things like that weren't really part of their lifestyle necessarily. But moving to the Northwest, you know, they kind of started to dabble in hiking and things like that. You know, there's so much that's accessible from Seattle. And then I ended up being one of the kids on the ski school bus, you know, the mogul mite. And then, you know, kind of grew up and like took more lessons and actually became a ski and a snowboard instructor in high school. And at some point, in early high school, I came to the realization that we were like hiking to the top of these, you know, steep ski and snowboard lines. Kind of realized that I was like pretty into going up, and that really transpired into, by the time I was 18 years old, I had actually like pretty much given up sliding down and was pretty hellbent on climbing. And at that point I moved back to New Zealand for university. And since it's a socialized country and, I have a citizenship, it was really, really cheap to go to school down there. Mm-hmm. And went down there and studied hydroglaciology, so how water flows over, through, and under glaciers, and then went climbing as much as I could. And the southern Alps of New Zealand, on the South Island, are kind of like a mini Himalaya. There are huge glaciers, these big walls, they're like these badass mountains. And so I was able to really just spend a lot of my time cutting my teeth in those mountains and really learning how to deal with, you know, pretty rugged alpine environment. And by the time I was what, like 21 and graduated from school, I was climbing some of the harder routes in the country. And at that point started going on expeditions and started like figuring out how to pay for trips and would just kind of work whatever jobs I needed to pay for them. And then started going to Alaska, started going to, some of the big mountains of Asia and started going to Patagonia. And then after a couple of years of that, I realized that I really needed to improve my like specific climbing abilities. So I spent a couple of years, like mostly big wall climbing and going ice climbing and rock climbing and big wall climbing is like El Cap and stuff like that. And so I did a bunch of that and then went back to the mountains and started really climbing the things that I wanted to climb. Started really being able to get up some big, steep, unclimbed walls in Alaska and in other parts of the world. And that was really kind of when I saw that I was like capable of doing these things that I really wanted to. And it's been a progression that I've been pursuing ever since. Since I think that first like big success was in like 2010. And I think since then, I think I've been on an expedition at least one every year for the last 15 years. And a bunch of years I've been on more like 3 or 4. It's just kind of been like, it's been this thing that I have just totally fallen in love with and has really filled my cup. And it's worth noting that it's taught me you know, a lot more than just like about climbing. You know, climbing for me has been this thing that's taught me about partnership. It's taught me about trying hard. It's taught me about dedication, and it's given me a lot of tools for, you know, work outside of climbing. Because while these days I'm a professional, you know, alpinist, I've always maintained work outside of climbing. It's kind of, you know, it's like, if you're going to like get real, like being a pro alpinist isn't something that's going to like carry me into retirement age. And I certainly don't make enough from it that I like, well, you know, be able to like retire at 30 or something. So, you know, I worked as a geophysicist for a long time. And then I ran a film production company for a long time. And I recently sold that and started working at Protect Our Winters on climate policy, which is kind of the biggest project I have these days, is jamming on that, which is pretty sweet.
Okay. And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later. We covered a lot of ground right there. And I have some questions. I have some follow-up questions.
Get it.
So I am intrigued by this notion that you were a ski/snowboard instructor, and you were climbing up and then skiing down, obviously. And at some point, the switch flipped for you, and you found that you enjoyed going up more than going down. And, you know, going up is much harder than going down, right? I mean, going down should be, you know, if you know how to ski, if you know how to snowboard, it's an easy thing to do. You certainly burn more calories and exert yourself more going up. And so what is you choosing that harder direction? What does that say about you as a person, as an individual?
You know, this is a funny thing, and it's something that kind of makes me giggle, because, you know, I feel ultra fortunate that I discovered something that I am so dedicated towards, something that like, that gets me so fired up and has taken me so many places and taught me so many things.
Your passion is easily seen as you're talking about this.
Dude, I mean, I love it. It's like, it's something that makes me really happy. And so I feel really fortunate that I found something like that. That's something that I wish for everybody to do. The fact that it's like hacking up steep hills is kind of hilarious, because, you know, it is like you said, skiing down tends to be a lot more fun, but the pacing of climbing, the challenge of climbing, the like logistics and the places where it can take you, it's pretty unreal. I mean, I've not found anything else like hanging off some, you know, 10,000 foot wall in the Pakistani Karakoram. It's like pretty badass. And so I've just been chasing that dream for a bunch of years, and it's been pretty wonderful.
It sounds like a lot has worked out for you.
I think so. I mean, and there have definitely been a lot of bumps along the way. Mm-hmm. You know, like figuring out how to pay for stuff, injuries, like, I mean, for sure, like it's been a real privilege to be able to like pursue all this stuff. But it only feels like just in the last few years, I've really figured out how to balance it properly, which has kind of been the more recent project of like, I'm married these days, you know, we have a house and a dog, and it's like, it's like going to the big mountains for 3 months while also managing those things takes a lot of work. So, which is like, it only feels like it's just coming together. And it's, you know, it's one of the great things about this sport is like, just keeps teaching me stuff. It keeps challenging me, whether it's in the mountains or outside of them.
Right. Now, you mentioned you went to New Zealand for your college education, and then you also started kind of climbing more out there, and you kind of said you cut your teeth out there. Was there formal training involved there? I mean, did you sign up with a group that kind of went through the basics and how to do this, or are you self-taught?
That's a great question. So, actually in the later years of high school, I did do like a 12-day course, in the North Cascades. And that was, you know, that was as much as anything to learn about like rescue technique and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I really do, think that some professional training in mountain sports, particularly like technical alpinism, is something that's really important, because, you know, there are systems that keep you safe, and there are systems that will allow you to get out of a pickle if something goes wrong. But you got to know them. Otherwise, you can get up there and just be totally hosed. So those are really important. And then I spent a lot of time, well, not a lot of time, I spent a few years on the Yosemite Search and Rescue team as well, which is a very like technical rescue team in Yosemite. That's how I mm-hmm. paid for some expeditions in the late aughts. And the so that was, you know, The late aughts. Totally. so that was, you know, and we really like technical proficiency was a big part of the programming there. Like, you know, it's like if you're rescuing people off of LCAP and stuff like that, you got to know what the hell you're doing with the rope. So that's like, so those are all skills that have been really, really helpful for me in terms of like getting out of hard places in the mountains or getting down out of storms and that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, I'm learning all kinds of things here that weren't in our outline, but I want to ask these side questions if you don't mind. Search and rescue team in Yosemite. Do you have a favorite rescue story?
Yeah, I do. I mean, to be honest, in search and rescue, lots of times like things don't end well. And my favorite rescue I was on, there was a couple who was out hiking and they got lost. And they've been gone for like 2.5 days. And when people have gone there for that long, it's like, you're probably not going to find them alive. And there they were, like, you know, wicked hungry, hanging out like in a, on a little island in a small stream. So they were able to get away from the canopy and be viewed from a like aerial search. And then we were able to go in and nab them. And yeah, man, it's like, search and rescue is something where you deal with a lot of things that are really challenging. A lot of aftermath of accidents, and that stuff's awful. And so having one where it's like, they were just fine. It was like, we were just able to give them a Cliff Bar and hike them out of there and take them to dinner. And that's like, when it comes to rescue scenarios, that is the outcome that you're looking for. So that was like, remember that one just being like, oh, thank goodness. Like finally, like just found them and they're in one piece and they're happy and all they need is a meal.
That's right. Successful, not messy. And you got them out of there. So that's great. And totally. Also you kind of stumbled right across a pro tip there, potential pro tip that if you're lost in the wilderness, you want to get out from underneath the canopy and be somewhere where you could be seen from the air.
Yeah. Visible. Yep.
Okay.
Totally.
You also mentioned earlier that there's been some transferability of the skills and philosophy and outlook on life that you have picked up in climbing to your non-climbing life. What are some of those skills that transfer well?
Yeah, man, that's a great question. I mean, in terms of like, you know, if we're going to talk about partnership, you know, it's like when you're on the mountain, like you have to work with somebody and oftentimes under duress. And that's something that, you know, like for relationships that I'm in, whether it's romantic partnerships, like my relationship with my wife, business partnerships, that kind of thing. It's like, man, you gotta like you gotta operate under duress sometimes. Like sometimes things are stressful. Sometimes things aren't perfect. And climbing is like climbing oftentimes takes that and really exacerbates it. Right. It makes it like kind of extreme, particularly when you're like tied at the side of a mountain and a storm's blowing in or whatever. And so it's, you know, it's like understanding yourself when you're operating in a challenging situation, understanding others, understanding how, you know, it's like how you react to others under like reading others and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. can be really helpful. And then in climbing, you know, I've tried harder on, you know, in the mountains than I have really anywhere else from like a physical and mental standpoint, just trying really hard to get to the top of something. And, you know, you take that into, your ability, you know, to like deal with hard shit at work or that kind of thing. It's pretty helpful. You know, it's like when there's a big project at work and you're like, oh my God, you know, like, you know, how am I going to get through this? Or how are we going to figure this out? Or how are we going to bring this in under budget or whatever? It makes it so that like, you know, it's like, cool. You know, I kind of know how to remain calm and like collected.
When mentally you go back to K6 West and say, oh, I can do that. If I did that, I can do this.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Now, is your wife a climber as well?
She's not. No, you can do a whole podcast about her. She's way cooler than I am. She's like a 2-time world champion, ultimate Frisbee player turned like corporate badass. So she's great. I mean, the running joke in the house is that she has 2 world championships and that I've just got 1. So she's doing better than I am. And she retired in like 2014. So she does not climb. She will she'll sometimes go to the climbing gym just for fitness or whatever. But these days mostly we ride bikes together, which is real, real fun. But climbing is just my thing.
Got it. Now, GZ, you have to talk me up to her so that we can do a follow-up episode with her and talk about her world championships.
Dude, yeah, it's good shit.
Okay. Nice. Now, you also seem to me to be a logistics guy. I think if you're doing expeditions, if you sign on to expeditions, there's a lot of planning and preparation ahead of time. You just don't go out there and freewheel it and say, hey, just hope for the best. It's all going to work out. There's a lot of planning that goes through with this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a really important component because, I mean, particularly if you're like going on a 3-month expedition to Pakistan, it's like when you arrive in Pakistan, you're not, you know, if you forget like a rope or a harness or something like that, like you're not going to replace it in country. So you got to really make sure your ducks are in a row. And, you know, like right now, like I leave on a relief for a trip to Alaska in about 2.5 weeks. And it's like, man, that's like, I've got the garage is just kind of like all the stuff's laid out so I can go putter around out there and make sure everything's there and make sure, you know, make sure I didn't forget anything. And, you know, and then there are like the kind of primary components that you like need, but then there's all the kind of nice to have stuff that, that makes it better, easier, whatever. And so it's just kind of just making sure it's all there. And yeah, it's like, you know, logistics are really important. And then as you start looking at the greater ranges, there's this really interesting component to when you're looking for things that haven't been climbed before. You're oftentimes looking for things that are kind of adjacent to conflict zones from on a geopolitical standpoint. So like a lot of the like best climbing that's like best first ascents that are available in Pakistan right now are actually pretty close to the Indian border because a lot of that's been closed for a long time. So instead of, you know, like, being in a position where you're kind of going back to the zones that everybody goes, you're kind of like trying to like push the boundaries a little bit and like see if you can get into zones that have been closed for a while. And I have a climbing partner, Steve Swenson, who's like been very successful with that for a long time. He's a lot older than I am. He's in his 60s, but yeah, it's like, it's kind of this like logistics component where you're like tracking the foreign affairs of what's going on. And then you have like, you know, you kind of working on developing contacts with the local military and the ISI and then the local politicians to kind of understand like if things are safe and if they might be able to get in there. And then like, and then one of the, you know, and then you go try, but it's like, you know, it's kind of this thing where you actually can't try that much because then you get flagged and as like somebody who wants to be close to the border. So it's kind of this, like, it's this really interesting game of,
it sounds like a very delicate dance.
Yeah, it totally. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so it's so cool to have this like direct relationship with, like, you know, international foreign affairs.
It's a whole nother layer. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then like in 2019, we were like right up against the border with India in a fully militarized zone, like next to an army camp. And it was, you know, we were there for the summer and it was like pretty wild, just kind of kicking it with these soldiers for the summer. And they were great. And it was like this amazing cultural experience spending time with these guys. And they also thought we were absolutely bananas trying to climb this peak above base camp.
So if you were perceived as crazier than the soldiers, then you probably come out on the, you know, the better result of there. So,
yeah, I mean, we all managed to find some common ground, you know.
Nice. It reminds me of Tommy Caldwell when he was 18 and he was climbing somewhere. Was it Pakistan or was it like Kazakhstan or somewhere out there?
Yeah.
And he was taken hostage. And that's an incredible story in itself right there. So some of the best climbing is you're right in the middle of some difficult geopolitical situations.
Dude, totally. Yeah. That situation they had in Southwest Kyrgyzstan was pretty awful. That was like, mm-hmm. those bad stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Yosemite. Before we go to break real quick, what's your favorite climb in Yosemite? Big wall climb.
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, if you're talking about big wall climbs in Yosemite, you gotta like, the nose is classic. It's not particularly hard. It's not like, you know, it gets done all the time, but man, it is very good. And that's like, that's that kind of that central pillar feature coming down the front of El Cap. And it's like, it's pretty wicked. It's like starts as a slab and then goes vertical and then goes overhanging at the top. It's like, and it's this cool route that is not only beautiful to look at, but the climbing on it is also incredible. So that would have to be the choice.
Nice. And they once said that El Capitan was unclimbable, that nobody would ever climb it. Until I don't know if I'm sure that you have seen Valley Uprising. They talk about the history of climbing in Yosemite, and someone finally did it in 18 months. It took them 18 months. They go up and they come down. Yep. They go up, come down. Supplies are, and then once it was done, once it was accomplished, once people realized it was possible, then the time frame to complete it got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until you've got Alex Honnold going up in, you know, 3 hours with no gear, right? So
totally,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, somebody probably once said the PCT was impossible as well, though. So
that's right.
So it's all about finding boundaries, pushing them.
Okay. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear some stories from the mountains from GZ. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back. From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. Welcome back. We're talking to GZ, also known as Graham Zimmerman, alpinist, about some of his adventures and background. And, you know, I mentioned it early on. I referred to it. I think I called it the golden axe. It's actually the golden ice axe. In French, it's the piolet d'or. Did I come close on that?
As close as I'm going to get.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. And this is an annual mountaineering award. It's considered mountaineering's highest honor. Think of it as the Oscars of mountaineering and climbing. And in 2014, you were a top five finalist. And in 2020, you were the recipient. You won it.
They gave us the golden ice axe. Yep.
Congratulations. That is really impressive.
Hey, thanks, Migo. It's like, you know, in climbing, like accolades are like, you know, climbing is not a competition, at least the type of climbing I participate in. Get a competitive mindset, you're probably just going to get killed. But the accolades and the kudos are really fun. And they certainly make my mother proud, which is great.
Got to make mom proud. Excellent. Yeah. Now, what in the world did you do in 2020 that got you the golden ice axe?
So it was actually in 2019, they award it the year after. So in 2019, we made the first ascent of a peak called Linxar, which is was an unclimbed 23,000 foot peak in the Pakistani Karakoram. And this is cool. I've been tried like 9 times by a bunch of very talented parties. And we had tried it once before in 2017. And, you know, it was a pretty amazing climb. It's like the peak itself is huge. It's very steep. It's very steep on all sides. It's kind of like one of those peaks. It's like, there's no easy way up. And it's really like, it's just that classic, like pointy peak. If you were like to ask a kid to draw a mountain, like a steep mountain, that's what they would draw. And then the climb itself was really cool. I mean, it took 2 full expeditions to actually get the thing done. In the end, it was a 9 day climb, up and down. So I think 6 days up and 3 days down. And it really like it took, we had a 4-man team on it. We climbed in what they refer to as alpine style. So like very like by fair means, just kind of the ropes tied between us heading up the hill. And it had some very technical climbing. It had some very hard climbing. It had some really steep climbing. It had some really interesting like strategic kind of challenges in terms of like how to get through different sections or when to climb different sections, depending on like sun exposure and things like that. And it was cool because we were, you know, we like put in a lot of effort to make sure that we could climb this very intense peak safely. And we were able to execute on that. So that was like, you know, that feels really good. Like, there was one kind of incident near the top where I was hit by an avalanche and took a fall, but even like, and I walked away from that, which was awesome. But, even if I had, you know, hurt myself, we had like so much experience on the team in terms of rescues and for, you know, first aid and medical stuff that it's like, it would have been fine. So, it would have been a different story, of course, but yeah, it was like, we really put in a lot of effort to like keep it reeled in so that we could feel good about what we were doing versus, you know, climbing. It can be kind of tempting to like push over the edge and like do things that are kind of out there, but it's like, you know, that's not how you become an old climber. So, it was a really cool trip.
And I just know from my own experience being on top of Whitney at 14.5, that decision-making at sea level is not the same as decision-making in your case at 23,000 feet. And so you're right, being cautious, making the right decisions, living to be an old climber, very important, but it's processing time, I have to imagine, a little bit slower up there.
Yeah. I mean, that's why experience is so important, because then you get a lot of habit, you know, you process habit differently. So if you're up there, like making fresh decisions based on like all new information and new things, then it would be really hard, but that's where like, you know, whatever 10 or 20 years of experience come into play, and
right.
10 to 20 years of like, not only climbing, but also like paying attention. And that's kind of the key component that makes it all work out. It's like really like paying attention so that when you see things, you know, you start to see things that repeat, you start to like repeat methodologies, you start to, you know, you're constantly having to make decisions based on new information, but the more like, you know, past information you have, the better the decisions you can make going forward.
Right. And GZ, what do you think you did differently in 2019, differently than those other 9 expeditions that allowed you to get to the top?
You know, there were some kind of like logistics things and stuff like that we were able to improve. We did add a fourth partner as well. It was like great to have Mark Ritchie along. The biggest thing, honestly, though, like was in 2017, the weather was awful. We basically spent 3 months sitting in a storm, which happens sometimes. And that's kind of like, that's just part of the deal. But, you know, it's like you show up and you're ready to rage and like go and, you know, burn a bunch of calories, and you just end up sitting and eating Dalbot in base camp for a long time, which, for what it's worth, like has a lot of value. I love sitting in base camp, and it's like, there's no phone. There's no, you know, there's no like internet. There's no inbox. You're just like banging along. But yeah, it was like, you know, spending a whole trip and not getting on top of anything is also kind of challenging.
Well, again, congratulations for that. That's quite an accomplishment.
Hey, thanks, Migo. I appreciate it.
Hey, would you mind sharing some stories from Alaska? Something, anything you can tell us about your Mount Lawrence ascent?
Yeah, let's see. So Mount Lawrence is that's the peak we were nominated for. I'm like, whatever, top five or, you know, all that in 2014. And it was like, it's cool. They actually like sent us over for the ceremony and everything. And then we didn't get it in the end, but we still got the free trip to Chamonix. So that was cool. and that was a neat trip, because there was like this whole zone kind of adjacent to Denali. Denali is like the moderate route that everybody climbs on. Denali is called the West Buttress, and that's on the Cahilton Glacier. And then right next door to the Cahilton Glacier is this other glacier called the Lacuna. And the Lacuna is like pretty hard to get to. You can't like land a plane on it. You know, it's like 2 days of walking to get there, kind of from any direction. And, you know, remembering that like these Alaskan glaciers are huge. And my buddy Mark and I kind of spied from some aerial photography some really amazing looking peaks in this area, and so we took our first trip in there in 2011, which was a great trip. We had a really, really good climb in there, and then in 2014 we went in and made I think maybe they gave us the PLA, or that we like nominated us for the PLA in 14, and we actually did the route in 13. Gosh, this is working on my memory. I don't remember, but
altitude brain.
Like in there, you it, like the details, go look like in the American Alpine Journal or something. That's where the real details are. But we went, so we skied into this like amazing zone. It took like 2 days to ski to this base camp, and there's this massive, very steep mountain face there, and it took us like three attempts to get up it, you know, running into either danger climbing that it was too dangerous or too hard. And in the end, we're able to make the first ascent of this wall. And it was like, it was just like such a cool adventure to, instead of like oftentimes in Alaska, you kind of fly in, throw all your stuff out of the plane, and they're just kind of there at base camp. And instead we had like had a trek way back there, and we're back in the zone where nobody had really been before, climbing this unreal objective. And it was really special. It was really cool.
Any moments where you thought to yourself, what have I gotten myself into up here?
That trip was pretty reeled in. You know, I mean, we did some really hard climbing, and there was some, you know, some scary climbing and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's also a lot younger then. So I don't know if I like my prefrontal cortex was totally dialed in, but I, you know, I don't remember any like, oh man, like the, you know, it's gone bad. It was more like, it was more just a lot of try hard, a lot of like, you know, some cold bivouacs, some hard climbing, and then some like the final snow ridge was like this wild kind of like cornice thing that took forever. So yeah, so no, nothing that was like that far out, like on the danger scale, but just a lot of really pushing ourselves physically.
Nice. And switching from the mountains to Big Wall, do you have maybe top three moments on a portal edge?
You know, this is funny. Like people always think of sleeping on, yeah, people always think of like transporting from like where I am right now to a portal edge. And that would be pretty, that'd be pretty mentally stimulating. But the thing is that like, you have to remember that like when you get onto a portal edge, you've been hanging off the wall all day. And so when you actually go from like being in your harness and working your ass off, and then you like the exposure goes away because you're on the ledge and you're able to like lay down and you're able to kind of kick it and chill and eat food. You know, you're feeling pretty good at that point. So really like, you know, being on a portal edge is always like, wall camping is the coolest thing to do. I think it's like, it's amazing. And, people think of it like, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe you can sleep up there, but it's pretty easy to sleep. Also, you've been working hard, so you're tired.
Yeah. You gotta be exhausted at that point. So.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah.
All right. Hey, GZ, tell us about this thing, Protect Our Winters, an imperfect advocate, Protect Our Winters. What's that all about?
Yeah. So Protect Our Winters is an organization that started back in 2007 by a pro snowboarder named Jeremy Jones. And I'll tell you what, man, it's like, it is the most important work that I do these days. So for years I was on just kind of like their general athlete alliance. And then I was the captain of their climb team, and now I'm actually on staff managing their ambassador program or their alliance program. And the whole goal of POW is to enable professional athletes to utilize their stories from the mountains to push climate policy, and do so like not in like a super far left like hyper progressive way, instead to really look for like real solutions that run down the middle of the aisle and allow us to work on, you know, something that brings jobs to the table, that brings energy security to the table, that, and then at the same time, like allows us to continue to do the things that we love. So that's like, that's really turned into a lot of what I do. And it's just been this thing that's allowed me to use these stories from the big mountains, not just to like sell jackets or get people stoked to go like rage in the hills. Instead, it's like, we're able to utilize them to like drive climate policy and talk to folks about like the things that we've seen in order to like to activate new advocates from within our community. And and sometimes that means like going to DC and lobbying with representatives and senators, and other times that means just working with our local communities to encourage them to, you know, vote, call their reps, and you know, get involved. And man, it's like, it's pretty powerful because you have a lot of, mm-hmm. you have all these climbers, you have all these like pro skiers and pro runners and pro bikers and folks who are pro snowboarders, can't forget them. Folks, you know, folks who know how to try hard, know how to do hard things, are really good at telling stories, and also have an audience. And to get them activated on something like talking about climate tends to be pretty productive. So that's something that's really had me fired up recently.
Great. And there's a lot of scary headlines in the newspapers these days. How long before it's too late to make a difference?
Man, I mean, it's a hard question to answer. It's like, what is too late? I mean, we've got the IPCC is saying we've got 30 years of change baked into the cake already. So I think that the thing is like, if we're asking the question of, you know, oh gosh, when do we start working on this? Like the answer is yesterday. And that means that we need to do it now. And so, while like, you know, we could sit here and we could spend all day worrying about, you know, how am I going to pay the bills? We could sit here all day worrying about like, you know, what am I going to make for dinner? But if like, don't actually do it, then nothing will happen. And so that's really what the climate conversation is all about. There's a lot of talk, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of worry. And man, we gotta kind of get on it and like build more action into the system. Otherwise it's going to be, you know, it's gonna be challenging.
Well said. Hey, let's move to another topic here. Tell me about Tin Cup Whiskey.
Oh, hey, those guys and gals have been supporting my climate for a little while now. And I got to say, it's pretty fun to have a whiskey sponsor. I don't drink that much. But when I do, I drink Tin Cup.
Nice promo right there.
Totally. And I'll tell you what, the thing that really gets me stoked, I mean, the things that like, you know, the brands that I work with, like they have to make like the best equipment, right? That's just kind of part of the deal. Like I can't go climbing with stuff that doesn't work. But the thing that, you know, but there are a lot of companies that make pretty good equipment. There's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of great Gore-Tex jackets out there. There are a lot of great, ice, like carabiners and stuff like that. But there are a lot of things that will work. Some are better than others, of course. But the thing that really, like, besides like needing the best kit for the particular task, the thing that gets me that I really consider the most important is that their values as an organization are really in line with my own, particularly around climate policy and social equity. Those are like the two big things that I'm jamming on these days. And so that's that. My partnership with Tin Cup, like, is more about our like collective work on storytelling and giving people access to the outdoors and talking about social equity and climate than it is about like getting loaded or anything like that. I mean, like sipping whiskey is great, but man, like creating a more equitable society in which we deal with climate change, now that shit is rad. And that's like, that's what gets me fired up.
Mic drop. Nice. Hey, GZ, you know where we are?
Where are we?
The pro tip insight of the week.
That's right, Half Calf. It is time for GZ to share a bit of outdoor adventure wisdom for our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. What do you have for us, GZ?
Golly gee, pro tip. Sorry, I'm having to like think through here because I'm trying to think of something that's like good for everybody. Here we go. So, you know, it's like when you're skiing, when you're hiking, when you're out climbing, like, you know, foot health is a really important thing. Right. And I've started utilizing an antiperspirant on my feet, like a spray. Mm-hmm. It's actually something similar to what I use in my hands for rock climbing to keep them dry, because it's also really important for like grabbing little holds. But I've started utilizing an antiperspirant on my feet, this particularly from a brand called Rhino Skin. That's actually just up the street from me here. And man, it makes it so that you don't get like sopping wet feet. And that's really helpful when, you know, it's like when your feet get wet and your feet get swollen, like, man, things get uncomfortable and that's no fun. So yeah. I think that's one that works for everybody.
That's right. The old adage from thru hiking, if the feet aren't happy, the hiker isn't happy. That transfers to climbing as well. So well said.
Oh man, that's true everywhere.
Okay. So there you have it. That's it. This episode just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Graham. I want to thank him for joining us this week. GZ, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
Great question. Generally just at Graham Zimmerman on Instagram. I keep it pretty simple these days. That's where I talk about policy. That's where I talk about climbing. That's where I share what's getting me fired up and would love to have you along.
Okay. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmirror@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
Graham, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, some kind of media to keep our listeners connected to the outdoors during the off season or even during the season. So we call this our Adventure Media Recommendation. What do you have for us?
Golly, let's see. I read a lot. And the thing that I've read, I read it years ago and then I've reread it a couple of times recently, is a book called Barbarian Days by William Finnegan. And it's a surfing memoir. And it's like Man, it is some high quality reading. It's like some of the best storytelling that I've engaged with, and it's surfing, and I would highly recommend it.
Nice. Here we are, a traditionally hiking podcast talking to an alpinist who's recommending a surfing adventure media recommendation. So that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, we're hitting all the buttons.
Good storytelling is good storytelling. That's the deal.
That's right. That's right.
What have we not asked you?
Oh, Half Calf is really getting wild with her accent there. I'm not sure if that's a Kiwi accent or an English accent. She's not sure either. She's just winging it. Before we wrap things up, I've got one more segment for you called "What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About?"
Gosh, what is the last thing that I haven't told you about? Probably my dog. I really like my dog. We've talked about my wife, who's cooler than I am, and I've got this ridiculous labradoodle named Pebble, and man, I like didn't know I wanted a dog. We got a dog. Turns out having a dog is great. So that's like, she's, you know, she's our love and joy, and yeah, so that's probably the thing. You know, if you want the real inside scoop, it's like pretty normal, but pretty good. That's family, man.
Nice. Now, is Pebble her given name, or is that a trail name?
Probably both.
Nice.
Fair question.
All right. Hey, that's a wrap from the John Freaking Muir studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, GZ?
Oh man. Gosh, I mean, just, there are a lot of people that have put up with me through the years. So thanks to all of them. It's like climbing takes a village. So they know who they are, and I love them all.
Okay. Well, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you've had to dodge an avalanche on the way to a first ascent of Lynxar. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.